I was swept along with it. When they pulled away, Lissa felt her heart rate increase and her cheeks flush. "What exactly was that the definition of?" she asked, reliving how his mouth had felt.
"It means, I'm sorry," he said.
She looked away and nervously plucked at some of the grass. Finally, with a sigh, she looked back up. "Christian, was there ever anything between you and Jill or Mia?" He stared in surprise.
"What? How could you think that?"
"You spent so much time with them."
"There is only one person I have ever wanted," he said.
The steadiness of his gaze, of those crystal blue eyes, left no question as to who that person was.
"No one else has ever come close, in spite of everything, even with Avery."
"Christian, I'm so sorry for that."
"You don't have to."
"I do."
"Damn it," he said. "Will you let me finish a sen-"
"No," Lissa interrupted. And she leaned over and kissed him, a hard and powerful kiss that burned through her body, one that told her there was no one else in the world for her either. Well, apparently Tasha had been right. I was the only one who could bring them back together. I just somehow hadn't expected my arrest to play a role. I pulled away from her head to give them some privacy and save myself from watching them make out. I didn't begrudge them their moment. There was nothing either could do for me right now, and they deserved their reunion. Their only course of action was to wait for more information, and really, their method of passing time was a lot healthier than whatever Adrian was probably doing. I lay down on the bed and stared up at the ceiling. There was nothing but plain metal and neutral colors around me. It drove me crazy. I had nothing to watch, nothing to read. I felt like an animal trapped in a cage. The room seemed to grow smaller and smaller. All I could do was replay what I'd learned via Lissa, analyzing every word of what had been said. I had questions about everything, of course, but the one thing that stuck with me was Daniela mentioning a hearing. I needed to know more about that. I got my answer hours later. I'd fallen into sort of a numb haze by then and almost didn't recognize Mikhail standing in front of my cell door. I leapt from my bed to the bars and saw that he was unlocking the door. Hope surged through me. "What's going on?" I asked. "Are they letting me go?"
"I'm afraid not," he said. His point was proven when, after opening the door, he promptly put my hands in cuffs. I didn't fight it. "I'm here to take you to your hearing."
Stepping into the hall, I saw other guardians gathered. My own security detail. A mirror of Dimitri's. Lovely. Mikhail and I walked together, and mercifully, he spoke along the way instead of maintaining that awful silence that seemed to be common treatment for prisoners. "What's the hearing exactly? A trial?"
No. Too soon for a trial. A hearing decides whether you're going to trial."
"That sounds kind of like a waste of time," I pointed out. We emerged from the Guardian's building, and that fresh, damp air was the sweetest thing I'd ever tasted.
"It's a bigger waste of time if you go to a full-fledged trial, and they realize there was no case to stand on. At the hearing, they'll lay out all the evidence they have, and a judge, or, well, someone acting as a judge, will decide if you should have a trial. The trial makes it official. That's where they pass the verdict and dole out the punishment."
"Why'd they take so long for the hearing? Why'd they make me wait in the cell all day?" He laughed, but not because he thought it was funny.
"This is fast, Rose. Very fast. It can take days or weeks to get a hearing. And if you do go to trial, you'll stay locked up until then."
I swallowed. "Will they move fast on that too?"
"I don't know. No monarch's been murdered in almost 100 years. People are running wild, and the council wants to establish order. They're already making huge plans for the queen's funeral, a giant spectacle that'll distract everyone. Your hearing is also an attempt to establish order."
"What? How?"
The sooner they convict the murderer, the safer everyone will feel. They think this case against you is so solid, they want to rush it through. They want you to be guilty. They want to bury her knowing her killer is moving toward justice, so that everyone can sleep easy when the new king or queen is elected. But I didn't.
I let my denial go. There was no point. Ahead of us, the building that housed the courtroom loomed. It had seemed forbidding the first time I'd been here for Victor's trial, but that had been owing to fear of the memories he'd sparked in me. Now it was my own future on the line. And apparently not just my own future. The Moroi world was watching and waiting, hoping I was a villain who could be safely put away forever. Swallowing, I gave Mikhail a nervous look.
Do you think they'll send me to trial?
He didn't answer. One of the guards held the door open for us. Mikhail? I urged.
Will they really put me on trial for murder?
Yes, he said sympathetically. I'm pretty sure they will.
Chapter 27. Walking into the courtroom was one of the most surreal experiences of my life. And not just because I was the one being accused here. It just kept reminding me of Victor's trial. And the idea that I was now in his place was almost too weird to comprehend. Entering a room with a troop of guardians makes people stare. And believe me, there were a lot of people packed in there. So naturally, I didn't skulk or look ashamed. I walked with confidence, my head held high. Again, I had that eerie flashback to Victor. He too had walked in defiantly, and I'd been appalled that someone who had committed his crimes could behave that way. Were these people thinking the same thing about me? On the dais at the front of the room sat a woman I didn't recognize. Among the Moroi, a judge was usually a lawyer who had been appointed to the position for the purposes of the hearing or whatever. The trial itself, at least a big one like Victor's, had been presided over by the queen. She had been the one to ultimately decide the final verdict. Here, the council members would be the ones to decide if I even reached that stage. The trial makes it official. That's where they pass the verdict and dole out the punishment. My escort took me to the front seating of the room, past the bar that separated the key players from the audience, and motioned me toward a spot next to a middle-aged Moroi in a very formal and very designer black suit. The suit screamed, "I'm sorry, the queen is dead, and I'm going to look fashionable while showing my grief." His hair was a pale blonde, lightly laced with the first signs of silver. Somehow, he made it look good. I presumed this was Damon Taurus, my lawyer, but he didn't say a word to me. Mikhail sat beside me as well, and I was glad they'd chosen him to be the one who literally didn't leave my side. Glancing back, I saw Daniela and Nathan Ivashkov sitting with other high-ranking royals and their families. Adrian had chosen not to join them. He sat further back, with Lissa, Christian, and Eddie. All of their faces were filled with worry. The judge, an elderly gray-haired Moroi who looked like she could still kick ass, called the room to attention, and I twisted around to face forward again. The council was entering, and she announced them one by one. Two sets of benches had been arranged for them, two rows of six with a 13th in back raised. Of course, only 11 of the spots were filled, and I tried not to scowl. Lissa should have been sitting there. When the council was settled, the judge turned to face the rest of us and spoke in a voice that rang through the room.
"This hearing is now in order, in which we will determine whether there is enough evidence to..."
A commotion at the door cut her off, and the audience craned their necks to see what was going on.
"What's this disturbance about?"
the judge demanded. One of the guardians had the door partially open and was leaning out, apparently speaking to whoever was in the hall. He ducked back into the room.
"The accused lawyer is here, Your Honor."
The judge glanced at Damon and me, and then delivered a frown to the guardian.
She already has a lawyer.
The guardian shrugged and appeared comically helpless. If there had been a Strigoi out there, he would have known what to do. This bizarre interruption of protocol was beyond his skill set. The judge sighed.
Fine, send whoever it is up here and let's get this settled.
Abe walked in.
Oh, dear Lord, I said out loud.
I didn't have to scold myself for speaking out of turn because a hum of conversation immediately filled the room. My guess was that half were in awe because they knew Abe and his reputation. The other half were probably just stunned by his appearance. He wore a gray cashmere suit, considerably lighter than Damon's grim black. Underneath it was a dress shirt that was so bright a white, it seemed to glow, particularly next to the brilliant crimson silk tie he wore. Other spots of red were scattered about his outfit. A handkerchief in the pocket, ruby cufflinks. Naturally, it was all as perfectly tailored and expensive as Damon's outfit. But Abe didn't look like he was in mourning. He didn't even look like he was coming to a trial. It was more like he'd been interrupted on his way to a party. And of course, he sported his usual gold hoop earrings and trimmed black beard. The judge silenced the room with a hand motion as he strutted up to her.
Abraham Mazur,
she said with a shake of her head. There were equal parts amazement and disapproval in her voice.
This is unexpected.
Abe swept her a gallant bow.
It's lovely to see you again, Paula. You haven't aged a day.
We aren't at a country club, Mr. Mazur, she informed him. And while here, you will address me by my proper title.
Ah, right. He winked. My apologies, Your Honor.
Turning, he glanced around until his eyes rested on me.
There she is. Sorry to have delayed this. Let's get started.
Damon stood up.
What is this? Who are you? I'm her lawyer.
Abe shook his head.
There must have been some mistake. It took me a while to get a flight here, so I can see why you would have appointed a community lawyer to fill in.
Community lawyer?
Damon's face grew red with indignation.
I'm one of the most renowned lawyers among American Maroi.
Renowned community.
Abe shrugged and leaned back on his heels.
I don't judge. No pun intended.
Mr. Mazur?
Interrupted the judge.
Are you a lawyer?
I'm a lot of things, Paula, Your Honor. Besides, does it matter? She only needs someone to speak for her.
And she has someone, exclaimed Damon.
Me? Not anymore,
said Abe, his demeanor still very pleasant. He had never stopped smiling. But I thought I saw that dangerous glint in his eyes that frightened so many of his enemies. He was the picture of calm, while Damon looked like he was ready to have a seizure.
Your Honor, enough,
she said in that resounding voice of hers.
Let the girl choose.
She fixed her brown eyes on me.
Who do you want to speak for you?
My mouth dropped open at how abruptly the attention shifted to me. I'd been watching the drama between the two men like a tennis match, and now the ball had hit me in the head.
Rose?
Startled, I turned slightly. Daniela Ivashkov had crept over in the row behind me.
Rose,
she whispered again.
You have no idea who that Mazur man is.
Oh, didn't I?
You want nothing to do with him. Damon's the best. He's not easy to get.
She moved back to her seat, and I looked between my two potential lawyers' faces. I understood Daniela's meaning. Adrian had talked her into getting Damon for me, and then she had talked Damon into actually doing it. Rejecting him would be an insult to her, and considering she was one of the few Royal Maroi who'd been nice to me about Adrian, I certainly didn't want to earn her dislike. Besides, if this was some set up by royals, having one of them on my side was probably my best chance at getting off. And yet, there was Abe, looking at me with that clever smile of his. He was certainly very good at getting his way. But a lot of that was by force of his presence and reputation. If there really was some absurd evidence against me, Abe's attitude wouldn't be enough to make it go away. Of course, he was sly too. The serpent. He could make the impossible happen. He'd certainly pulled a lot of strings for me. That did not, however, change the fact that he wasn't a lawyer. On the other hand, he was my father. He was my father, and although we still barely knew each other, he'd gone to great lengths to get here and saunter in with his gray suit to defend me. Was it fatherly love gone bad? Was he really all that good a lawyer? And at the end of the day, was it true that blood ran thicker than water? I didn't know. I actually didn't like that saying. Maybe it worked for humans, but it made no sense with vampires. Anyway, Abe was staring at me intently with dark brown eyes nearly identical to mine. "Trust me," he seemed to say. But could I? Could I trust my family? I would have trusted my mother if she were here, and I knew she trusted Abe. I sighed and gestured toward him. "I'll take him." In an undertone, I added, "Don't let me down, Zmay." Abe's smile grew broader as shocked exclamations filled the audience, and Damon protested in outrage. Daniela might have had to persuade him to take me on in the beginning, but now this case had become a matter of pride for him. His reputation had just been sullied by me passing him up. But I'd made my choice, and the exasperated judge would hear no more arguments about it. She shooed Damon away, and Abe slid into his seat. The judge began with the standard opening speech, explaining why we were here, etc., etc. As she spoke, I leaned toward Abe. "What have you gotten me into?" I hissed to him.
"Me? What have you gotten yourself into? Couldn't I have just picked you up at the police station for underage drinking like most fathers?"
I was beginning to understand why people got irritated when I made jokes in dangerous situations. "My fucking future's on the line. They're going to send me to trial and convict me." Every trace of humor or cheer vanished from his face. His expression grew hard, deadly serious. A chill ran down my spine.
"That," he said in a low, flat voice, "is something I swear to you is never, ever going to happen."
The judge turned her attention back to us and the prosecutor's lawyer, a woman named Iris Kane. Not a royal name, but she still looked pretty hardcore. Maybe that was just a lawyer thing. Before the evidence against me was laid out, the Queen's murder was also described in all its grisly detail. How she'd been found this morning in bed, a silver stake through her heart and a profound look of horror and shock on her face. Blood had been everywhere. On her nightgown, the sheets, her skin. The pictures were shown to everyone in the room, triggering a variety of reactions. Gasps of surprise, more fear and panic. And some people wept. Some of those tears were undoubtedly because of the whole terrible situation. But I think many cried because they loved or liked Tatiana. She'd been cold and stiff at times, but for the most part, her reign had been a peaceful and just one. After the pictures, they called me up. The hearing didn't run the way a normal trial did. There was no formal switching back of lawyers as they questioned witnesses. They each just sort of stood there and took turns asking questions while the judge kept order. "Miss Hathaway," began Iris, dropping my title, "what time did you return to your room last night?"
"I don't know the exact time."
I focused on her and Abe, not the sea of faces out there.
"Somewhere around 5 a.m., I think, maybe 6.
"Was anyone with you?"
"No, well, yes, later."
Oh, God, here it comes.
Adrian Ivashkov visited me.
"What time did he arrive?"
asked Abe. "I'm not sure of that either. A few hours after I got back, I guess."
Abe turned his charming smile on Iris, who was rustling through some papers.
The Queen's murder has been pretty accurately narrowed down to between 7 and 8. Rose wasn't alone. Of course, we would need Mr. Ivashkov to testify to that effect.
My eyes flicked briefly to the audience. Daniela looked pale. This was her nightmare. Adrian getting involved. Glancing farther over, I saw that Adrian himself seemed eerily calm. I really hoped he wasn't drunk. Iris held up a sheet of paper triumphantly.
We have a signed statement from a janitor who says Mr. Ivashkov arrived at the defendant's building at approximately 9:20.
That's pretty specific, said Abe.
He sounded amused, like she'd said something cute.
Do you have any desk staff to confirm that?
No, Iris said icily. But this is enough. The janitor remembers because he was about to take his break. Miss Hathaway was alone when the murder took place. She has no alibi.
Well, said Abe, at least according to some questionable facts.
But no more was said about the time. The evidence was admitted to the official records, and I took a deep breath. I hadn't liked that line of questioning, but it had been expected, based on the earlier conversations I'd heard via Lissa. The no alibi thing wasn't good, but I kind of shared Abe's vibe. What they had so far still didn't seem strong enough to send me to trial. Plus, they hadn't asked anything else about Adrian, which left him out of this.
Next exhibit, said Iris.
There was smug triumph all over her face. She knew the time thing was sketchy, but whatever was coming up, she thought it was gold. But actually, it was silver. A silver stake. So help me, she had a silver stake in a clear plastic container. It gleamed in the incandescent lighting, except for its tip. That was dark, with blood.
This is the stake used to kill the queen, declared Iris. Miss Hathaway's stake.
Abe actually laughed.
Oh, come on, guardians are issued stakes all the time. They have an enormous identical supply.
Iris ignored him and looked at me.
Where is your stake right now?
I frowned. In my room? She turned and glanced out over the crowd.
Guardian Stone?
A tall dompier with a bushy black mustache rose from the crowd.
Yes.
You conducted the search of Miss Hathaway's room and belongings, correct?
I gaped in outrage. You searched my... A sharp look from Abe silenced me.
Correct,
said the guardian.
And did you find any silver stakes?
Asked Iris.
No.
She turned back to us, still smug. But Abe seemed to find this new information even more ridiculous than the last batch.
That proves nothing. She could have lost the stake without realizing it.
Lost it in the queen's heart?
Miss Kane,
warned the judge.
My apologies, Your Honor,
said Iris smoothly. She turned to me.
Miss Hathaway, is there anything special about your stake? Anything that would distinguish it from others?
Yes.
Can you describe that?
I swallowed. I had a bad feeling about this. It has a pattern etched near the top, a kind of geometric design. Guardians had engravings done sometimes. I'd found this stake in Siberia and kept it. Well, actually, Dmitri had sent it to me after it had come loose from his chest. Iris walked over to the council and held out the container so that each of them could examine it. Returning to me, she gave me my turn.
Is this your pattern? Your stake?
I stared. It was indeed. My mouth opened, ready to say yes, but then I caught Abe's eye. Clearly, he couldn't talk directly to me, but he sent a lot of messages in that gaze. The biggest one was to be careful. Be sly. What would a slippery person like Abe do?
It looks similar to the design on mine, I said at last. But I can't say for sure if it's the exact same one.
Abe's smile told me I'd answered correctly.
Of course you can't.
Iris said as though she'd expected no better. She handed off the container to one of the court clerks.
But now that the council has seen that the design matches her description and is almost like her steak, I would like to point out that testing has revealed...
She held up more papers, victory all over her face.
That her fingerprints are on it.
There it was, the big score, the hard evidence.
Any other fingerprints?
Asked the judge.
No, Your Honor, just hers.
That means nothing, said Abe with a shrug.
I had a feeling that if I stood and suddenly confessed to the murder, he would still claim it was dubious evidence.
Someone steals her steak and wears gloves. Her fingerprints would be on it because it's hers.
That's getting kind of convoluted, don't you think?
Asked Iris.
The evidence is still full of holes,
he protested.
That's what's convoluted. How could she have gotten into the queen's bedroom? How could she have gotten through the guards?
Well, mused Iris, those would be questions best explored in trial, but considering Miss Hathaway's extensive record of breaking into and out of places, as well as the countless other disciplinary marks she has, I don't doubt she could have found any number of ways to get inside.
You have no proof, said Abe. No theory.
We don't need it, said Iris. Not at this point. We have more than enough to go to trial, don't we? I mean, we haven't even got to the part where countless witnesses heard Miss Hathaway tell the Queen she'd regret reestablishing the recent guardian law. I can find the transcript if you like, not to mention reports of other expressive commentary Miss Hathaway made in public.
A memory came back to me of standing outside with Daniela while I ranted, with others watching, about how the Queen couldn't buy me off with an assignment. Not a good decision on my part. Neither was busting in on the death watch or complaining about the Queen being worth protecting when Lyssa had been captured. I'd given Iris a lot of material.
Oh, yes, Iris continued. We also have accounts of the Queen declaring her extreme disapproval of Miss Hathaway's involvement with Adrian Ivashkov, particularly when the two ran off to elope.
I opened my mouth at that, but Abe silenced me.
There are countless other records of Her Majesty and Miss Hathaway sparring in public. Would you like me to find those papers too, or are we able to vote on a trial now?
This was directed at the judge. I had no legal background, but the evidence was pretty damning. I would have said that there was definitely reason to consider me a murder suspect. Except... Your Honor? I asked. I think she'd been about to give her declaration. Can I say something? The judge thought about it, then shrugged. I see no reason not to. We're collecting all the evidence there is. Oh, me freelancing was not in Abe's plan at all. He strode to the stand, hoping to stop me with his wise counsel, but he wasn't fast enough. Okay, I said, hoping I sounded reasonable and wasn't going to lose my temper. You've put up a lot of suspicious stuff here. I can see that. Abe looked pained. It was not an expression I'd seen on him before. He didn't lose control of situations very often. But that's the thing. It's too suspicious. If I were going to murder someone, I wouldn't be that stupid. Do you think I'd leave my steak stuck in her chest? Do you think I wouldn't wear gloves? Come on, that's insulting. If I'm as crafty as you claim my record says I am, then why would I do it this way? I mean, seriously, if I did it, it'd be a lot better. You'd never even peg me as a suspect. This is all really kind of an insult to my intelligence.
Rose,
began Abe, a dangerous note in his tone. I kept going. All this evidence you've got is so painfully obvious. Hell, whoever set this up might as well have painted an arrow straight to me. And someone did set me up, but you guys are too stupid to even consider that. The volume of my voice was rising, and I consciously brought it back to normal levels. You want an easy answer, a quick answer, and you especially want someone with no connections, no powerful family to protect them. I hesitated there, unsure how to classify Abe. Because that's how it always is. That's how it was with that age law. No one was able to stand up for the Dompierres either, because this goddamn system won't allow it. It occurred to me then that I had strayed pretty far off the subject, and was making myself look more guilty by slamming the age law. I reined myself back in. Anyway, Your Honor, what I'm trying to say is that this evidence shouldn't be enough to accuse me or send me to trial. I wouldn't plan a murder this badly.
Thank you, Miss Hathaway, said the judge. That was very informative. You may take your seat now while the council votes.
Abe and I returned to our bench.
What in the world were you thinking?
He whispered. I was telling it like it is. I was defending myself.
I wouldn't go that far. You're no lawyer.
I gave him a sidelong look. Neither are you, old man. The judge asked the council to vote on whether they believed there was enough evidence to make me a viable suspect and send me to trial. They did. 11 hands went up. Just like that. It was over. Through the bond, I felt Lissa's alarm. As Abe and I rose to leave, I looked out in the audience, which was starting to disband and buzzing with talk over what would happen now. Her light green eyes were wide, her face unusually pale. Beside her, Adrian too looked stressed. But as he stared at me, I could see love and determination radiating. And in the back, behind both of them, Dimitri. I hadn't even known he was here. His eyes were on me, too, dark and endless. Only I couldn't read what he was feeling. His face betrayed nothing, but there was something in his eyes, something intense and intimidating. The image of him ready to take down that group of guardians flashed through my mind, and something told me that if I asked, he would do it again. He would fight his way to me through this courtroom and do everything in his power to rescue me from it. A brushing of my hand distracted me from him. Abe and I had started to exit, but the aisle ahead of us was packed with people bringing us to a halt. The touch against my hand was a small piece of paper shoved between my fingers. Glancing over, I saw Ambrose was sitting near the aisle, staring straight ahead. I wanted to ask what was going on, but some instinct kept me silent. Seeing as the line still wasn't moving, I hastily opened the paper, keeping it out of Abe's sight. The paper was tiny, its elegant cursive almost impossible to read. Rose, if you're reading this, then something terrible has happened. You probably hate me, and I don't blame you. I can only ask that you trust that what I did with the age decree was better for your people than what others had planned. There are some Maroi who want to force all Dompierres into service, whether they want it or not, by using compulsion. The age decree has slowed that faction down. However, I write to you with a secret you must put right, and it is a secret you must share with as few as possible. Vasilisa needs her spot on the council, and it can be done. She is not the last Dragomir. Another lives, the illegitimate child of Eric Dragomir. I know nothing else, but if you can find this son or daughter, you will give Vasilisa the power she deserves. No matter your faults and dangerous temperament, you are the only one I feel can take on this task. Waste no time in fulfilling it. Tatiana Ivashkov. I stared at the piece of paper, its writing swirling before me, but its message burning into my mind. She is not the last Dragomir. Another lives. If that was true, if Lissa had a half-brother or half-sister, it would change everything. She would get a vote on the council. She would no longer be alone. If it was true, if this was from Tatiana, anyone could sign her name to a piece of paper. It didn't make it real. Still, I shivered, troubled at the thought of getting a letter from a dead woman. If I allowed myself to see the ghosts around us, would Tatiana be there, restless and vengeful? I couldn't bring myself to let down my walls and look. Not yet. There had to be other answers. Ambrose had given me the note.
I needed to ask him. Except we were moving down the aisle again. A guardian nudged me along.
"What's that?"
asked Abe, always alert and suspicious. I hastily folded the note back up. "Nothing." The look he gave me told me he didn't believe that at all. I wondered if I should tell him. It is a secret you must share with as few as possible. If he was one of the few, this wasn't the place. I tried to distract him from it and shake the dumbstruck look that must have been on my face. This note was a big problem, but not quite as big as the one immediately facing me.
"You told me I wouldn't go to trial," I said to Abe. My earlier annoyance returned. "I took a big chance with you."
"It wasn't a big chance. Taurus couldn't have got you out of this either."
Abe's easy attitude about all this infuriated me further. "Are you saying you knew this hearing was a lost cause from the beginning?" It was what Mikhail had said, too. How nice to have such faith from everyone.
"This hearing wasn't important," Abe said evasively. "What happens next is."
"And what is that exactly?" He gave me that dark, sly gaze again.
"Nothing you need to worry about yet."
One of the guardians put his hand on my arm, telling me I needed to move. I resisted his pull and leaned toward Abe.
"The hell I don't! This is my life we're talking about!" I exclaimed.
I knew what would come next. Imprisonment until the trial. And then more imprisonment if I was convicted.
"This is serious. I don't want to go to trial. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in a place like Tarasov."
The guard tugged harder, pushing us forward, and Abe fixed me with a piercing gaze that made my blood run cold.
"You will not go to trial. You will not go to prison," he hissed, out of the guard's hearing. "I won't allow it. Do you understand?"
I shook my head, confused over so much and not knowing what to do about any of it.
"Even you have your limits, old man."
His smile returned.
"You'd be surprised. Besides, they don't even send royal traitors to prison, Rose. Everyone knows that."
I scoffed.
"Are you insane? Of course they do. What else do you think they do with traitors? Set them free and tell them not to do it again?"
"No," said Abe just before he turned away. "They execute traitors."
This is Emily Schaefer. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Spirit Bound, a Vampire Academy novel by Rochelle Mead. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Garrett Scott. Spirit Bound is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2010. All rights reserved. The book Spirit Bound is available wherever Razorbill books are sold.
Audible.com and Penguin Young Readers Group present Vampire Academy, written by Rochelle Mead and read by Stephanie Wolf. Chapter 1. I felt her fear before I heard her screams. Her nightmare pulsed into me, shaking me out of my own dream, which had something to do with a beach and some hot guy rubbing suntan oil on me. Images, hers, not mine, tumbled through my mind. Fire and blood, the smell of smoke, the twisted metal of a car. The pictures wrapped around me, suffocating me until some rational part of my brain reminded me that this wasn't my dream. I woke up, strands of long, dark hair sticking to my forehead. Lissa lay in her bed, thrashing and screaming. I bolted out of mine, quickly crossing the few feet that separated us. "Liss," I said, shaking her. "Liss, wake up." Her screams dropped off, replaced by soft whimpers.
"Andre,
she moaned.
Oh, God.
I helped her sit up. Liz, you aren't there anymore. Wake up. After a few moments, her eyes fluttered open, and in the dim lighting, I could see a flicker of consciousness start to take over. Her frantic breathing slowed, and she leaned into me, resting her head against my shoulder. I put an arm around her and ran a hand over her hair. It's okay, I told her gently. Everything's okay.
I had that dream.
Yeah, I know. We sat like that for several minutes, not saying anything else. When I felt her emotions calm down, I leaned over to the nightstand between our beds and turned on the lamp. It glowed dimly, but neither of us really needed much to see by. Attracted by the light, our housemate's cat, Oscar, leapt up onto the sill of the open window. He gave me a wide berth. Animals don't like vampires for whatever reason, but jumped onto the bed and rubbed his head against Lissa, purring softly. Animals didn't have a problem with Moroi, and they all loved Lissa in particular. Smiling, she scratched his chin, and I felt her calm further. When did we last do a feeding? I asked, studying her face. Her fair skin was paler than usual. Dark circles hung under her eyes, and there was an air of frailty about her. School had been hectic this week, and I couldn't remember the last time I'd given her blood. It's been, like, more than 2 days, hasn't it? Three? Why didn't you say anything? She shrugged and wouldn't meet my eyes.
You were busy. I didn't want to...
Screw that, I said, shifting into a better position. No wonder she seemed so weak. Oscar, not wanting me any closer, leapt down and returned to the window, where he could watch at a safe distance. Come on, let's do this.
Rose,
come on. It'll make you feel better. I tilted my head and tossed my hair back, baring my neck. I saw her hesitate, but the sight of my neck and what it offered proved too powerful. A hungry expression crossed her face, and her lips parted slightly, exposing the fangs she normally kept hidden while living among humans. Those fangs contrasted oddly with the rest of her features. With her pretty face and pale blonde hair, she looked more like an angel than a vampire. As her teeth neared my bare skin, I felt my heart race with a mix of fear and anticipation. I always hated feeling the latter, but it was nothing I could help, a weakness I couldn't shake. Her fangs bit into me hard, and I cried out at the brief flare of pain. Then it faded, replaced by a wonderful golden joy that spread through my body. It was better than any of the times I'd been drunk or high, better than sex, or so I imagined, since I'd never done it. It was a blanket of pure, refined pleasure, wrapping me up and promising everything would be right in the world. On and on it went. The chemicals in her saliva triggered an endorphin rush, and I lost track of the world, lost track of who I was. Then, regretfully, it was over. It had taken less than a minute. She pulled back, wiping her hand across her lips as she studied me.
You okay?
Yeah. I lay back on the bed, dizzy from the blood loss. I just need to sleep it off. I'm fine. Her pale, jade-green eyes watched me with concern. She stood up.
I'm going to get you something to eat.
My protest came awkwardly to my lips, and she left before I could get out a sentence. The buzz from her bite had lessened as soon as she broke the connection, but some of it still lingered in my veins, and I felt a goofy smile cross my lips. Turning my head, I glanced up at Oscar, still sitting in the window. You don't know what you're missing, I told him. His attention was on something outside. Hunkering down into a crouch, he puffed out his jet black fur. His tail started twitching. My smile faded, and I forced myself to sit up. The world spun, and I waited for it to right itself before trying to stand. When I managed it, the dizziness set in again, and this time refused to leave. Still, I felt okay enough to stumble to the window and peer out with Oscar. He eyed me warily, scooted over a little, and then returned to whatever had held his attention. A warm breeze, unseasonably warm for a Portland fall, played with my hair as I leaned out. The street was dark and relatively quiet.
It was 3 in the morning, just about the only time a college campus settled down, at least somewhat. The house in which we'd rented a room for the past 8 months sat on a residential street with old, mismatched houses. Across the road, a streetlight flickered, nearly ready to burn out. It still cast enough light for me to make out the shapes of cars and buildings. In our own yard, I could see the silhouettes of trees and bushes, and a man watching me. I jerked back in surprise. A figure stood by a tree in the yard, about 30 feet away, where he could easily see through the window. He was close enough that I probably could have thrown something and hit him. He was certainly close enough that he could have seen what Lissa and I had just done. The shadows covered him so well that even with my heightened sight, I couldn't make out any of his features, save for his height. He was tall, really tall. He stood there for just a moment, barely discernible, and then stepped back, disappearing into the shadows cast by the trees on the far side of the yard. I was pretty sure I saw someone else move nearby and join him before the blackness swallowed them both. Whoever these figures were, Oscar didn't like them. Not counting me, he usually got along with most people, growing upset only when someone posed an immediate danger. The guy outside hadn't done anything threatening to Oscar, but the cat had sensed something. Something that put him on edge. Something similar to what he always sensed in me. Icy fear raced through me, almost, but not quite, eradicating the lovely bliss of Lissa's bite. Backing up from the window, I jerked on a pair of jeans that I found on the floor, nearly falling over in the process. Once they were on, I grabbed my coat and Lissa's, along with our wallets. Shoving my feet into the first shoes I saw, I headed out the door. Downstairs, I found her in the cramped kitchen, rummaging through the refrigerator. One of our housemates, Jeremy, sat at the table, hand on his forehead as he stared sadly at a calculus book. Lissa regarded me with surprise.
You shouldn't be up.
We have to go. Now. Her eyes widened, and then a moment later, understanding clicked in.
Are you... really? Are you sure?
I nodded. I couldn't explain how I knew for sure. I just did. Jeremy watched us curiously.
What's wrong?
An idea came to mind. Liss, get his car keys. He looked back and forth between us.
What are you?
Lissa unhesitatingly walked over to him. Her fear poured into me through our psychic bond. But there was something else, too. Her complete faith that I would take care of everything. That we would be safe. Like always, I hoped I was worthy of that kind of trust. She smiled broadly and gazed directly into his eyes. For a moment, Jeremy just stared, still confused, and then I saw the thrall seize him. His eyes glazed over, and he regarded her adoringly.
"We need to borrow your car," she said in a gentle voice. "Where are your keys?"
He smiled and I shivered. I had a high resistance to compulsion, but I could still feel its effects when it was directed at another person. That, and I'd been taught my entire life that using it was wrong. Reaching into his pocket, Jeremy handed over a set of keys hanging on a large red keychain.
"Thank you," said Lissa. "And where is it parked?"
"Down the street," he said dreamily. "At the corner. By Brown.
4 blocks away.
"Thank you," she repeated, backing up. "As soon as we leave, I want you to go back to studying. Forget you ever saw us tonight."
He nodded obligingly. I got the impression he would have walked off a cliff for her right then if she'd asked. All humans were susceptible to compulsion, but Jeremy appeared weaker than most. That came in handy right now.
"Come on," I told her. "We've got to move."
We stepped outside, heading toward the corner he'd named. I was still dizzy from the bite and kept stumbling, unable to move as quickly as I wanted. Lissa had to catch hold of me a few times to stop me from falling. All the time, that anxiety rushed into me from her mind. I tried my best to ignore it. I had my own fears to deal with.
"Rose, what are we going to do if they catch us?" she whispered.
"They won't," I said fiercely.
I won't let them.
But if they found us...
They found us before. They didn't catch us then. We'll just drive over to the train station and go to L.A. They'll lose the trail. I made it sound simple. I always did, even though there was nothing simple about being on the run from the people we'd grown up with. We'd been doing it for 2 years, hiding wherever we could and just trying to finish high school. Our senior year had just started, and living on a college campus had seemed safe. We were so close to freedom. She said nothing more, and I felt her faith in me surge up once more. This was the way it had always been between us. I was the one who took action, who made sure things happened, sometimes recklessly so. She was the more reasonable one, the one who thought things out and researched them extensively before acting. Both styles had their uses, but at the moment, recklessness was called for. We didn't have time to hesitate. Lissa and I had been best friends ever since kindergarten, when our teacher had paired us together for writing lessons. Forcing 5-year-olds to spell Vasilisa Dragomir and Rosemary Hathaway was beyond cruel, and we'd, or rather, I'd, responded appropriately. I'd chucked my book at our teacher and called her a fascist bastard. I hadn't known what those words meant, but I'd known how to hit a moving target. Lissa and I had been inseparable ever since.
"Do you hear that?" she asked suddenly.
It took me a few seconds to pick up what her sharper senses already had. Footsteps, moving fast. I grimaced. We had 2 more blocks to go.
"We've got to run for it," I said, catching hold of her arm. "But you can't run."
It took every ounce of my willpower not to pass out on the sidewalk. My body didn't want to run after losing blood or while still metabolizing the effects of her saliva. But I ordered my muscles to stop their bitching and clung to Lissa as our feet pounded against the concrete. Normally, I could have outrun her without any extra effort, particularly since she was barefoot, but tonight, she was all that held me upright. The pursuing footsteps grew louder, closer. Black stars danced before my eyes. Ahead of us, I could make out Jeremy's green Honda. Oh, God, if we could just make it! 10 feet from the car, a man stepped directly into our path. We came to a screeching halt, and I jerked Lissa back by her arm. It was him, the guy I'd seen across the street, watching me. He was older than us, maybe mid-20s, and as tall as I'd figured, probably 6'6 or 6'7. And, under different circumstances, say when he wasn't holding up our desperate escape, I would have thought he was hot. Shoulder-length brown hair, tied back in a short ponytail. Dark brown eyes, a long brown coat, a duster, I thought it was called. But his hotness was irrelevant now. He was only an obstacle keeping Lissa and me away from the car and our freedom. The footsteps behind us slowed, and I knew our pursuers had caught up. Off to the sides, I detected more movement, more people closing in. God, they'd sent almost 12 guardians to retrieve us. I couldn't believe it. The Queen herself didn't travel with that many. Panicked, and not entirely in control of my higher reasoning, I acted out of instinct. I pressed up to Lissa, keeping her behind me and away from the man who appeared to be the leader. "Leave her alone," I growled. "Don't touch her." His face was unreadable, but he held out his hands in what was apparently supposed to be some sort of calming gesture, like I was a rabid animal he was planning to sedate.
"I'm not going to..."
He stepped forward, too close. I attacked him, leaping out in an offensive maneuver I hadn't used in 2 years, not since Lissa and I had run away. The move was stupid, another reaction born of instinct and fear, and it was hopeless. He was a skilled guardian, not a novice who hadn't finished his training. He also wasn't weak and on the verge of passing out. And man, was he fast. I'd forgotten how fast guardians could be, how they could move and strike like cobras. He knocked me off as though brushing away a fly, and his hand slammed into me and sent me backwards. I don't think he meant to strike that hard, probably just intended to keep me away. But my lack of coordination
interfered with my ability to respond. Unable to catch my footing, I started to fall, heading straight toward the sidewalk at a twisted angle, hip first. It was going to hurt. A lot. Only, it didn't. Just as quickly as he'd blocked me, the man reached out and caught my arm, keeping me upright. When I'd steadied myself, I noticed he was staring at me, or more precisely, at my neck. Still disoriented, I didn't get it right away. Then, slowly, my free hand reached up to the side of my throat and lightly touched the wound Lissa had made earlier. When I pulled my fingers back, I saw slick, dark blood on my skin. Embarrassed, I shook my hair so that it fell forward around my face. My hair was thick and long and completely covered my neck. I'd grown it out for precisely this reason. The guy's dark eyes lingered on the now-covered bite a moment longer and then met mine. I returned his look defiantly and quickly jerked out of his hold. He let me go, though I knew he could have restrained me all night if he'd wanted. Fighting the nauseating dizziness, I backed toward Lissa again, bracing myself for another attack. Suddenly, her hand caught hold of mine. "Rose," she said quietly, "don't." Her words had no effect on me at first, but calming thoughts gradually began to settle in my mind, coming across through the bond. It wasn't exactly compulsion. She wouldn't use that on me. But it was effectual, as was the fact that we were hopelessly outnumbered and outclassed. Even I knew struggling would be pointless. The tension left my body, and I sagged in defeat. Sensing my resignation, the man stepped forward, turning his attention to Lissa. His face was calm. He swept her a bow, and managed to look graceful doing it, which surprised me considering his height. "My name is Dmitry Belikov," he said. I could hear a faint Russian accent. "I've come to take you back to St. Vladimir's Academy, princess." Chapter 2. My hatred notwithstanding, I had to admit, Dmitry Belikov-whatever was pretty smart. After they'd carted us off to the airport and on to the Academy's private jet, he'd taken one look at the two of us whispering and ordered us separated. "Don't let them talk to each other," he warned the guardian, who escorted me to the back of the plane. "5 minutes together and they'll come up with an escape plan." I shot him a haughty look and stormed off down the aisle. Never mind the fact we had been planning escape. As it was, things didn't look good for our heroes, or heroines, rather. Once we were in the air, our odds of escape dropped further. Even supposing a miracle occurred and I did manage to take out all 10 guardians, we'd sort of have a problem in getting off the plane. I figured they might have parachutes aboard somewhere, but in the unlikely event I'd be able to operate one, there was still that little issue of survival, seeing as we'd probably land somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. No, we weren't getting off this plane until it landed in backwoods Montana. I'd have to think of something then, something that involved getting past the Academy's magical wards and 10 times as many guardians. Yeah, no problem. Although Lissa sat in the front with the Russian guy, her fear sang back to me, pounding inside my head like a hammer. My concern for her cut into my fury. They couldn't take her back there, not to that place. I wondered if Dmitry might have hesitated if he could feel what I did, and if he knew what I knew. Probably not. He didn't care. As it was, her emotions grew so strong that for a moment, I had the disorienting sensation of sitting in her seat, in her skin even. It happened sometimes, and without much warning, she'd pull me right into her head. Dmitry's tall frame sat beside me, and my hand, her hand, gripped a bottle of water. He leaned forward to pick up something, revealing 6 tiny symbols tattooed on the back of his neck. Molnia marks. They looked like 2 streaks of jagged lightning, crossing in an X symbol. 1 for each Strigoi he'd killed. Above them was a twisting line, sort of like a snake, that marked him as a guardian.
the promise mark. Blinking, I fought against her and shifted back into my own head with a grimace. I hated when that